This is Audible.
You are about to hear Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism by Vladimir Lenin, narrated by Joseph Kent. Copyright 2018, ABN Publishing. Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Lenin wrote Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, early in 1916, while on exile in Switzerland. Although the manuscript was at the printer by October 1916, the book itself did not appear in St. Petersburg until September 1917, apparently as a result of the general confusion and disorganization in Russia during this period. The book was written for open, legal publication in Russia. Lenin had Tsarist censorship in mind and devised means to circumvent it. Employing what he characterized as Aesopian language, he used non-Russian examples to illustrate points about Russia. As Lenin commented later, "It is painful in these days of liberty to read these squeezed-in passages of the pamphlet, crushed, as they seem, in an iron vice, distorted on account of the censor." He went on to explain, "The careful reader will easily substitute Russia for Japan, and Finland, Poland, Courland, and the Ukraine, Kiva, Bokhara, Estonia, and other regions peopled by non-Great Russians for Korea." To Lenin, imperialism is the dominance of finance capital. Specifically, he does not define imperialism as it is generally defined, namely, the building of empires by subjugation of territories and the exploitation of these colonial territories for new materials and as markets. Indeed, as early as the World War I period, Lenin believed this form of imperialism was outmoded. Instead, he concerned himself with what he asserted was the inevitable next stage of imperialism, where the have-nations could and would dominate the have-not-nations simply by the export of capital itself. By this means, the rich nations would not need to exploit the poor nations to secure raw materials for their own industries, nor would they need to utilize the poor nations as captive markets. They could merely collect the continuing income from their capital while all the actual work was performed in the have-not debtor nations. It's obvious what this would cause in the wealthy nations themselves. The financiers would divert their capital to the foreign locales, where it would produce the highest returns, and refrain from aiding industry in their own countries, resulting in industrial stagnation in the wealthy nations. This, in turn, would intensify the division between the productive working classes and the non-productive investing classes within the wealthy nations. This, Lenin predicts, is the final, stagnant, parasitic, revolutionary stage of capitalism. To emphasize his case, Lenin deliberately does not draw upon Marx or Marxist economists for substantiation, but instead chooses to utilize non-Marxist sources for statistics and quotations. Of particular interest to the contemporary American reader is Lenin's attention to the history of American industry and finance, his references to the business techniques of the robber barons of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, his analysis of the conflict between large and small capital, and his striking predictions concerning the development and role of the modern corporation. Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, appears here complete. Chapter 1. Concentration of Production and Monopolies. The enormous growth of industry and the remarkably rapid process of concentration of production in ever larger enterprises represent one of the most characteristic features of capitalism. Modern censuses of production give complete and exact information on this process. In Germany, for example, for every 1,000 industrial enterprises, large enterprises, i.e., those employing more than 50 workers, numbered 3 in 1882, 6 in 1895, 9 in 1907, and out of every 100 workers employed, this group of enterprises, on the dates mentioned, employed 22, 30, and 37 respectively. Concentration of production, however, is much more intense than the concentration of workers, since labor in the large enterprises is much more productive. This is shown by the figures available on steam and electric motors. If we take what in Germany is called industry in the broad sense of the term, that is, including commerce, transport, etc., we get the following picture. Large-scale enterprises, 30,588 out of a total of 3,265,623, that is to say, 0.9%. These large-scale enterprises employ 5,700,000 workers out of a total of 14,400,000. That is 39.4%. They use 6,600,000 steam horsepower out of a total of 8,800,000. That is 75.3%. And 1,200,000 kilowatts of electricity out of a total of 1,500,000. That is 77.2%. Less than 1/100th of the total enterprises utilize more than 3/4 of the steam and electric power. 2,970,000 small enterprises, employing up to 5 workers, represent 91% of the total, utilize only 7% of the steam and electric power. Tens of thousands of large-scale enterprises are everything. Millions of small ones are nothing. In 1907, there were in Germany 586 establishments employing 1,000 and more workers. They employed nearly 1/10, 1,380,000, of the total number of workers employed in industry and utilized almost 1/3, 32%, of the total steam and electric power employed. As we shall see, money capital and the banks made this superiority of a handful of the largest enterprises still more overwhelming in the most literal sense of the word, since millions of small, medium, and even some big masters are in fact in complete subjection to some hundreds of millionaire financiers. In another advanced country of modern capitalism, the United States, the growth of the concentration of production is still greater. Here, statistics single out industry in the narrow sense of the word, and group enterprises according to the value of their annual output. In 1904, the United States large-scale enterprises, with an annual output of $1 million and overnumbered 1,900 out of 216,180, that is, 0.9%, these employed 1,400,000 workers out of 5,500,000, i.e., 25.6%, and their combined annual output was valued at $5,600,000,000, out of $14,800,000,000, i.e. 38%. 5 years later, in 1909, the corresponding figures were large-scale enterprises 3,060 out of 268,491, i.e. 1.1%, employing 2 million workers out of 6,600, i.e. 30.5%. producing $9 billion out of $20,700,000, i.e. 43.8%. Almost half the total production of all the enterprises of the country was carried on by 1/100th part of those enterprises. These 3,000 giant enterprises embrace 268 branches of industry. From this, it can be seen that, at a certain stage of its development, concentration itself, as it were, leads right to monopoly. For a score or so of giant enterprises can easily arrive at an agreement, while on the other hand, the difficulty of competition and the tendency towards monopoly arise from the very dimensions of the enterprises. This transformation of competition into monopoly is one of the most important, if not the most important, phenomena of modern capitalist economy, and we must deal with it in greater detail. But first, we must clear up one possible misunderstanding. American statistics say 3,000 giant enterprises in 250 branches of industry, as if there were only a dozen large-scale enterprises for each branch of industry. But this is not the case. Not in every branch of industry are there large-scale enterprises. And moreover, a very important feature of capitalism in its highest stage of development is the so-called combine. That is to say, the grouping of a single enterprise of different branches of industry, which either represents the consecutive stages in the working up of raw materials, for example, the smelting of iron ore into pig iron, the conversion of pig iron into steel, and then, perhaps, the manufacture of steel goods. Or, are auxiliary to one another, for example, the utilization of waste or of byproducts, the manufacture of packing materials, etc. Combination, writes Hilferding, levels out the fluctuations of trade and therefore assures to the combined enterprises a more stable rate of profit. Secondly, combination has the effect of eliminating trading. Thirdly, it has the effect of rendering possible technical improvements and, consequently, the acquisition of super profits over and above those obtained by the pure, i.e. non-combined enterprises. Fourthly, it strengthens the position of the combined enterprises compared with that of pure enterprises. It increases their competitive power in periods of serious depression, when the fall of prices of raw materials does not keep pace with the fall in prices of manufactured articles. The German bourgeois economist Heyman, who has written a book especially on mixed, that is, combined enterprises in the German iron industry, says, "Non-combined enterprises perish, crushed by the high price of raw material and the low price of the finished product." Thus, we get the following picture. There remain, on one hand, the great coal companies, producing millions of tons yearly, strongly organized in their coal syndicate, and closely connected with them the big steel plants and their steel syndicate, and these great enterprises producing 400,000 tons of steel per annum, with correspondingly extensive coal, ore, and blast furnace operations, as well as the manufacturing of finished goods, employing 10,000 workers quartered in company houses, sometimes owning their own wharves and railways, are today the standard type of German iron and steel plant. And concentration continues. Individual enterprises are becoming larger and larger. An ever-increasing number of enterprises in one given industry, or in several different industries, joined together in giant companies, backed up and controlled by half a dozen Berlin banks. In the German mining industry, the truth of the teachings of Karl Marx on the concentration of capital is definitely proved, at any rate, in a country where it is protected by tariffs and freight rates. The German mining industry is ripe for expropriation. Such is the conclusion when a conscientious bourgeois economist, and such are exceptional, had to arrive at. It must be noted that he seems to place Germany in a special category, because her industries are protected by high tariffs. But the concentration of industry and the formation of monopolist manufacturers' combines, cartels, syndicates, etc. could only be accelerated by these circumstances. It is extremely important to note that in free trade England, concentration also leads to monopoly, although somewhat later and perhaps in another form. Professor Herman Levy, in his special investigation titled Monopolies, Cartels, and Trusts, based on data on British economic development, writes as follows. In Great Britain, it is the size of the enterprise and its capacity which harbor a monopolist tendency. This, for one thing, is due to the fact that the great investment of capital per enterprise, once the concentration movement has commenced, gives rise to increasing demands for new capital for the new enterprises, and thereby renders their launching more difficult. Moreover, and this seems to be the more important point, every new enterprise that wants to keep pace with the gigantic enterprises that have arisen on the basis of the process of concentration produces such an enormous quantity of surplus goods that it can only dispose of them either by being able to sell them profitably as a result of an enormous increase in demand, or by immediately forcing down prices to a level that would be unprofitable for both itself and for the monopoly combines. In England, unlike other countries, where the protective tariffs facilitate the formation of cartels, monopolist alliances of entrepreneurs, cartels, and trusts arise in the majority of cases only when the number of competing enterprises is reduced to a couple of dozen or so. Here the influence of the concentration movement on the formation of large industrial monopolies in a whole sphere of industry stands out with crystal clarity. 50 years ago, when Marx was writing Capital, free competition appeared to most economists to be a natural law. The official scientists tried, by a conspiracy of silence, to kill the works of Marx, which, by a theoretical and historical analysis of capitalism, showed that free competition gives rise to the concentration of production, which, in turn, at a certain stage of development, leads to monopoly. Today, monopoly has become a fact. The economists are writing mountains of books in which they describe the diverse manifestations of monopoly, and continue to declare in chorus that Marxism is refuted. But facts are stubborn things, as the English proverb says, and they have to be reckoned with, whether we like it or not. The facts show that differences between capitalist countries, e.g. in the matter of protection or free trade, only give rise to insignificant variations in the form of monopolies or in the moment of their appearance, and that the rise of monopolies, as the result of the concentration of production, is a general and fundamental law of the present stage of development for capitalism. For Europe, The time when the new capitalism was definitely substituted for the old can be established fairly precisely. It was the beginning of the 20th century. In one of the latest compilations on the history of the formation of monopolies, we read, "A few isolated examples of capitalist monopoly could be cited from the period preceding 1860. In these could be discerned the embryo of the forms that are common today, but all undoubtedly represent prehistory. The real beginning of modern monopoly goes back, at the earliest, to the 60s. The first important period of development of monopoly commenced with the International Industrial Depression of the 70s and lasted until the beginning of the 90s. If we examine the question on a European scale, we will find that the development of free competition reached its apex in the 60s and 70s. Then it was that England completed the construction of its old-style capitalist organization. In Germany, this organization had entered into a decisive struggle with handicraft and domestic industry, and had begun to create for itself its own forms of existence. The Great Revolutionization commenced with the crash of 1873, or rather, the depression which followed it, and which, with hardly discernible interruptions in the early 80s and the unusually violent but short-lived boom about 1889, marks 22 years of European economic history. During the short boom of 1889 to 90, the system of cartels was widely resorted to in order to take advantage of the favorable business conditions. An ill-considered policy drove prices still higher than would have been the case otherwise, and nearly all these cartels perished ingloriously in the smash. Another five-year period of bad trade and low prices followed, but a new spirit reigned in the industry. The Depression was no longer regarded as something to be taken for granted. It was regarded as nothing more than a pause before another boom. The cartel movement entered its second epoch. Instead of being a transitory phenomenon, the cartels became one of the foundations of economic life. They are winning one field after another, primarily the raw materials industry. At the beginning of the 90s, the cartel system had already acquired, in the organization of the Coke Syndicate, on the model of which the Coal Syndicate was later formed, a cartel technique which could hardly be improved. For the first time, the great boom at the close of the 19th century and the crisis of 1900 through 03 occurred entirely in the mining and iron industries, at least, under the aegis of the cartel. And while at that time it appeared to be something novel, now the general public takes it for granted that large spheres of economy have been, as a general rule, systematically removed from the realm of free competition. Thus, the principal stages in the history of monopolies are the following. 1. 1860 through 70, the highest stage, the apex of development of free competition. Monopoly is in the barely discernible embryonic stage. 2. After the crisis of 1873, a wide zone of development of cartels. But they are still the exception. They are not yet durable. They are still a transitory phenomenon. 3. The boom at the end of the 19th century and the crisis of 1900 through 03. Cartels become one of the foundations of the whole of economic life. Capitalism has been transformed into imperialism. Cartels come to agreement on the conditions of sale, terms of payment, etc. They divide the market among themselves. They fix the quantity of goods to be produced. They fix prices. They divide the profits among the various enterprises, etc. The number of cartels in Germany was estimated at about 250 in 1896 and at 385 in 1905, with about 12,000 firms participating. But it is generally recognized that these figures are underestimations. From the statistics of German industry for 1907 we quoted above, it is evident that even 12,000 large enterprises must certainly utilize more than half the steam and electric power used in the country. In the United States, the number of trusts in 1900 was 185, and in 1907, 250. American statistics divide all enterprises into three categories, according to whether they belong to individuals, to private firms, or to corporations. These latter in 1904 comprised 23.6%, and in 1909, 25.9%, i.e., more than one-fourth of the total industrial enterprises in the country. These employed in 1904, 70.6%, and in 1909, 75.6%, i.e. more than three-fourths of the total wage earners. Their output amounted at these two dates to $10.9 billion and to $16.3 billion respectively, i.e. to 73.7% and to 79% of the total. Not infrequently, cartels and trusts concentrate in their hands 7 or 8 tenths of the total output of a given branch of industry. The Rhine-Westphalian Coal Syndicate, at its foundation in 1893, controlled 86.7% of the total coal output in the area. In 1910, it controlled 95.4%. The monopoly so created ensures enormous profits and leads to the formation of technical productive units of formidable magnitude. The famous Standard Oil Company in the United States was founded in 1900. It has an authorized capital of $150 million. It issued $100 million worth of common shares and $106 million worth of preferred shares. From 1900 to 1907, they earned the following dividends: 48, 48, 45, 44, 36, 40, 40, 40% in the respective years, i.e., in all, $367 million. From 1882 to 1907, the Standard Oil Company made clear profits to the amount of $889 million, of which $606 million were distributed in dividends, and the rest went to reserve capital. In 1907, the various enterprises of the United States Steel Corporation employed no less than 210,180 workers and other employees. The largest enterprise in the German mining industry, Geisenkircher Bergwerks Gesellschaft, employed, in 1908, 46,048 wage earners. In 1902, the United States Steel Corporation produced 9 million tons of steel. Its output constituted, in 1901, 66.3%, and in 1908, 56.1% of the total output of steel in the United States. Its share of the output of mineral ore increased from 43.9% to 46.3% of the total output in the same period. The report of the American Government Commission on Trust states, "The superiority over their competitors is due to the magnitude of their enterprises and their excellent technical equipment. Since its inception, the Tobacco Trust devoted all its efforts to the substitution of mechanical for manual labor on an extensive scale. With this end in view, it bought up all patents that had anything to do with the manufacture of tobacco and spent enormous sums for this purpose. Many of these patents at first proved to be of no use and had to be modified by the engineers employed by the trust. At the end of 1906, two subsidiary companies were formed solely to acquire patents. With the same object in view, the trust built its own foundries, machine shops, and repair shops. One of these establishments, that in Brooklyn, employs on the average 300 workers. There, experiments are carried out on inventions concerning the manufacture of cigarettes, cheroots, snuff, tinfoil for packaging, boxes, etc. Here also, inventions are perfected. Other trusts employ so-called developing engineers whose business it is to devise new methods of production, think out new production processes, and to test technical improvements. The United States Steel Corporation grants big bonuses to its workers and engineers for all inventions suitable for raising technical efficiency, for improving machinery, or for reducing costs of production. In German large-scale industry, e.g. in the chemical industry, which has developed so enormously during these last few decades, the promotion of technical improvement is organized in the same way. In 1908, the process of concentration had already given rise to two main groups which, in their way, came close to being monopolies. First, these groups represented dual alliances of two pairs of big factories, each having a capital of from 20 to 21 million marks, on the one hand, the former Meister factory at the Hoechst and the Kassel factory at Frankfurt on Main, and at the other hand, the aniline and soda factory at Ludwigshafen and the former Bayer factory at Elberfeld. In 1905, one of these groups and in 1908, the other group, each concluded a separate agreement with yet another factory. The result was the formation of two triple alliances, each with a capital of from 40 to 50 million marks. And these alliances began to come close to one another, reaching an understanding about prices, etc. Competition becomes transformed into monopoly. The result is immense progress in the socialization of production. In particular, the process of technical innovation and improvement becomes socialized. This is no longer the old type of free competition between manufacturers, scattered and out of touch with one another, and producing for an unknown market. Concentration has reached the point at which it's possible to make an approximate estimate of all sources of raw material, for example, the iron ore deposits of a country, and even, as we shall see, of several countries, or of the whole world. Not only are such estimates made, but these sources are captured by gigantic monopolist alliances. An approximate estimate of the capacity of markets is also made, and the trusts divide them up among themselves by agreement. Skilled labor power is monopolized, the best engineers are engaged, the means of transport are captured, railways in America, shipping companies in Europe and America. Capitalism in its imperialist stage arrives at the threshold of the most complete socialization of production. In spite of themselves, the capitalists are dragged, as it were, into the new social order, which marks the transition from complete free competition to complete socialization. Production becomes social, but appropriation remains private. The social means of production remain the private property of a few. The framework of formally recognized free competition remains, but the yoke of a few monopolists on the rest of the population becomes 100 times heavier, more burdensome, and intolerable. The German economist, Kestner, has written a book especially on the subject of the struggle between the cartels and the outsiders, i.e., enterprises outside the cartels. He entitled his work Compulsory Organization, although, in order to present capitalism in its true light, he should have given it the title Compulsory Submission to Monopolist Combines. This book is edifying if only for the list it gives of the modern and civilized methods that monopolist combines resort to in their striving towards organization. They are as follows. 1. Stopping supplies of raw materials, one of the most important methods of compelling adherence to the cartel. 2. Stopping the supply of labor by means of alliances, i.e., of agreements between employers and the trade unions by which the latter permit their members to work only in trustified enterprises. 3. Cutting off deliveries. 4. Closing of trade outlets. 5. Agreements with the buyers by which the latter undertake to trade only with the cartels. 6. The systematic lowering of prices to ruin outside firms, i.e., those who refuse to submit to the trust. Millions are spent in order to sell goods for a certain time below their cost price. The price of benzene was thus lowered from 40 to 22 marks, i.e., reduced almost by half. 7. Stopping credits. 8. Boycott. This is no longer competition between small and large-scale industry or between technically developed and backward enterprises. Here we see the monopolies throttling those which do not submit to them, to their yoke, to their dictation. The following is the way in which this process is reflected in the mind of a bourgeois economist. Even in the purely economic sphere, writes Kestner, a certain change is taking place from commercial activity in the old sense of the word to organizational speculative activity. The greatest success no longer goes to the merchant whose technical and commercial experience enables him best of all to estimate the needs of the buyer and, so to say, to discover latent demand. It goes to the speculative genius, who knows how to estimate in advance, or even only to sense the organizational development and the possibilities of connections between individual enterprises and the banks. Translated into ordinary human language, this means that the development of capitalism has arrived at a stage when, although commodity production still reigns and continues to be regarded as the basis of economic life, it has, in reality, been undermined, and the big profits go to the genius of financial manipulation. At the basis of these swindles and manipulations lies socialized production. But the immense progress of humanity, which achieved this socialization, entirely goes to benefit the speculators. We shall see later how, on these grounds, reactionary, petty bourgeois critics of a capitalist imperialism dream of taking a step backward, of a return to free, peaceful, and honest competition. The prolonged raising of prices which results from the formation of cartels, says Kestner, has hitherto been observed only in relation to the most important means of production, such as coal, iron, and potassium, and has never been observed for any length of time in relation to manufactured goods. Similarly, the increase in profits resulting from that has been limited only to the industries which produce means of production. To this observation, we must add that the raw materials industry secures advantages from the cartel formation not only in regard to growth of income and profitableness, to the detriment of the finished goods industry, but also a dominating position over the latter, which did not exist under free competition. The words which we have italicized reveal the essence of the case which the bourgeois economists admit so rarely and so unwillingly, and which the modern defenders of opportunism, led by K. Kautsky, so zealously try to evade and brush aside. Domination and violence that is associated with it, such are the relationships that are most typical of the latest phase of capitalist development. This is what must inevitably result, and has resulted, from the formation of the all-powerful economic monopolies. We will give one more example of the methods employed by monopolies. It is particularly easy for cartels and monopolies to arise when it's possible to capture all the sources of raw materials, or at least the most important of them. It would be wrong, however, to assume that monopolies do not arise in other industries in which it is impossible to corner the sources of raw materials. The cement industry, for instance, can find its raw material everywhere. Yet in Germany, it is strongly trustified. The cement manufacturers have formed regional syndicates, South German, Rhine-Westphalian, etc. The prices fixed are monopoly prices, 230 to 280 marks a carload, at a cost price of 180 marks. The enterprises pay a dividend of from 12% to 16%. And let us not forget that the geniuses of modern speculation know how to pocket big profits besides those they draw by way of dividends. Now, in order to prevent competition in such a profitable industry, the monopolists resort to sundry stratagems. For example, they spread disquieting rumors about the situation of their industry. Anonymous warnings are published in the newspapers like the following. Investors, don't place your capital in the cement industry. They buy up outsiders, those outside the trusts, and pay them indemnities of 60,000, 80,000, and even 150,000 marks. Monopoly hews a path for itself without scruple to the means from modest, buying off the competitors to the American device of employing dynamite against them. The statement that cartels can abolish crises is a fable spread by bourgeois economists who at all costs desire to place capitalism in a favorable light. On the contrary, when monopoly appears in certain branches of industry, it increases and intensifies the anarchy inherent in capitalist production as a whole. The disparity between the development of agriculture and that of industry which is characteristic of capitalism is increased. The privileged position of the most highly trustified industry, i.e., so-called heavy industry, especially coal and iron, causes a still greater lack of concerted organization in other branches of production, such as Geitel's, the author of one of the best works on the relationship of the German big banks to industry, puts it, "The more developed an economic system is," writes Leifman, one of the most unblushing apologists of capitalism, "the more it resorts to risky enterprises or enterprises abroad, to those which need a great deal of time to develop, or finally to those which are only of local importance." The increased risk is connected in the long run with the prodigious increase of capital, which overflows at the brim, as it were, flows abroad, etc. At the same time, the extremely rapid rate of technical progress gives rise more and more to disturbances in the coordination between the various spheres of industry, to anarchy and crisis. Leifman is obliged to admit that, "In all probability, mankind will see further important technical revolutions in the near future which will also affect the economic system. For example, electricity and aviation. As a general rule, in such a period of radical economic change, speculation becomes rife." Crises of every kind, economic crises more frequently, but not only these, in their turn increase very considerably the tendency towards concentration and monopoly. In this connection, the following reflections of Geitel's on the crisis of 1900, which was, as we have already seen, the turning point in the history of modern monopoly, are exceedingly instructive. Side by side with the giant plants in the basic industries, the crisis of 1900 found many plants organized on lines that today would be considered obsolete, the pure, non-combined plants, which had also arisen on the crest of the industrial boom. The fall in prices and the falling off in demand put these pure enterprises in a precarious position, but did not affect some of the big combined enterprises at all, and affected others only for a very short time. As a consequence of this, the crisis of 1900 resulted in a far greater concentration of industry than the former crises, like that of 1873. The latter crisis also produced a sort of selection of the best-equipped enterprises, but owing to the level of technical development of that time, this selection could not place the firms which successfully emerged from the crisis in a position of monopoly. Such a durable monopoly exists to a high degree in the gigantic enterprises in the present iron and steel and electric industries, and to a lesser degree in the engineering industry and certain metal, transport, and other enterprises in consequence of their complicated technique, their extensive organization, and the magnitude of their capital. Monopoly. This is the last word on the latest phase of capitalist development. But we shall only have a very insufficient, incomplete, and poor notion of the real power and significance of modern monopolies if we do not take into consideration the part played by the banks. Chapter 2. The Banks and Their New Role. The principal and primary function of banks is to serve as an intermediary in the making of payments. In doing so, they transform inactive money capital into active capital, that is, into capital producing a profit. They collect all kinds of money revenues and place them at the disposal of the capitalist class. As banking develops and becomes concentrated in a small number of establishments, the banks become transformed, and instead of being modest intermediaries, they become powerful monopolies, having at their command almost the whole of the money capital of all the capitalists and small businessmen, and also a large part of the means of production and of the sources of raw materials of the given country and a number of countries. The transformation of numerous intermediaries into a handful of monopolists represents one of the fundamental processes in the transformation of capitalism into capitalist imperialism. For this reason, we must first of all deal with the concentration of banking. In 1907 to 1908, the combined deposits of the German joint stock banks, having a capital of more than a million marks, amounted to 7 billion marks, while in 1912 to 13, they amounted to 9,800,000,000 marks. Thus, in 5 years, their deposits increased by 40%. Of the 2,800,000,000 increase, 2,750,000,000 was divided among 57 banks, each having a capital of more than 10 million marks. The distribution of the deposits among the small and big banks was as follows. Percentage of total deposits. Period, 1907 to 08. In 9 Berlin banks, 47. In 48 other banks with a capital of more than 10 million, 32.5. In 115 banks with a capital of 1 to 10 million, 16.5. In the small banks, with a capital of less than 1 million, 4. Period 1912 to 13. In 9 big Berlin banks, 49. In 48 other banks, with a capital of more than 10 million, 36. In 115 banks, with a capital of 1 to 10 million, 12. In the small banks, with a capital of less than 1 million, 3. The small banks are being squeezed out by the big banks, of which 9 concentrate in their own hands almost half of the total deposits. But we have left out of account many important details. For instance, the transformation of numerous small banks practically into branches of big banks, etc. Of this, we shall speak later on. At the end of 1913, Schulz Gavernitz estimated the deposits in the 9 big Berlin banks at 5,100,000,000 marks, out of a total of 10 billion marks. Taking into account not only the deposits, but also the capital of these banks, this author wrote, "At the end of 1909, the 9 big Berlin banks, together with their affiliated institutions, controlled 11,276,000,000 marks, that is, about 83% of the total German bank capital. The Deutsche Bank, which together with its affiliated banks controls nearly 3 billion marks, represents parallel with the Prussian State Railway Administration, the biggest and also the most decentralized accumulation of capital in the Old World. We have emphasized the reference to affiliated banks because this is one of the most important features of modern capitalist concentration. Large-scale enterprises, especially the banks, not only completely absorb small ones, but also join them to themselves, subordinate them, bring them into their own group or concern, to use the technical term, by having holdings in their capital, by purchasing or exchanging shares, by controlling them through a system of credits, etc., etc. Professor Leafman has written a voluminous book of about 500 pages describing modern holding and finance companies, unfortunately adding theoretical reflections of a very poor quality to what is frequently partly digested raw material. To what results this holding system leads in regard to concentration is best illustrated in the book written by the banker Reiser on the big German banks. But before examining his data, we will quote an example of the holding system. The Deutsche Bank is one of the biggest, if not the biggest, banking group. In order to trace the main threads which connect all the banks in this group, it is necessary to distinguish between holdings of the first, second, and third degree, or what amounts to the same thing, between dependents of the lesser establishments on the Deutsche Bank, or the first, second, and third degree. We then obtain the following picture. The Deutsche Bank has holdings constantly, first degree in 17 banks, second degree of which 9 hold stock in 34 others, third degree of which 4 hold stock in 7 others. For an indefinite period, first degree in 5 banks. Occasionally, first degree in 5 banks, second degree of which 5 hold stock in 14 others, third degree of which 2 hold stock in 2 others. Total, first degree in 30 banks, second degree of which 14 hold stock in 48 others, third degree of which 6 hold stock in 9 others. Included in the 8 banks dependent on the Deutsche Bank in the first degree, occasionally there are 3 foreign banks, one Austrian, the Wiener Bankverein, and 2 Russian, the Siberian Commercial Bank and the Russian Bank for Foreign Trade. Altogether, the Deutsche Bank group comprises, directly and indirectly, partially and totally, no less than 87 banks, and the capital, its own and others which it controls, ranges between 2 and 3 billion marks. It's obvious that a bank which stands at the head of such a group, and which enters into an agreement with a half a dozen other banks only slightly smaller than itself for the purpose of conducting big and profitable operations, like floating state loans, is no longer a mere intermediary, but a combine of a handful of monopolists. The rapidity with which the concentration of banking proceeded in Germany at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries is shown in the following data, which we quote in an abbreviated form from Reiser. 6 big Berlin banks. Date. 1895. Branches in Germany, 16. Deposit banks and exchange offices, 14. Constant holdings in German joint stock banks, 1. Total establishments, 42. Date 1900, branches in Germany 21, deposit banks and exchange offices 40, constant holdings in German joint stock banks 8, total establishments 80. Date 1911, branches in Germany 104, deposit banks and exchange offices 276, constant holdings in German joint stock banks 63, total establishments 450. We see the rapid extension of a close network of canals which cover the whole country, centralizing all capital and all revenues, transforming thousands and thousands of scattered economic enterprises into a single national capitalist and then into an international capitalist economic unit. The decentralization that Schulz Gavernitz, as an exponent of modern bourgeois political economy, speaks of in the passage previously quoted, really means the subordination of an increasing number of formerly relatively independent, or rather, strictly local economic units, to a single center. In reality, it is centralization, the increase in the role, the importance, and the power of monopolist gains. In the old capitalist countries, this banking network is still more close. In Great Britain, including Ireland, in 1910, there were 7,151 branches of banks. Four big banks had more than 400 of these branches each, from 447 to 689. Four had more than 200 branches each, and 11 more than 100 each. In France, the three most important banks, Crédit Lyonnais, the Comptoir National des Escomptes de Paris, and the Société Générale, extended their operations and their network of branches in the following manner. Year 1870, number of branches and offices in the provinces 47, in Paris 17, total 64. Capital in million francs, own capital 200, loan capital 427. Year 1890, number of branches and offices in the provinces 192, in Paris 66, total 258. Capital in million francs, own capital 265, loan capital 1,245. Year 1909, number of branches and offices in the provinces 1,033, in Paris 196, in total 1,229. Capital in million francs, own capital 887, loan capital 4,363. In order to show the connections of a big modern bank, Reiser gives the following figures of the number of letters dispatched and received by the Disconto Gesellschaft, one of the most important banks in Germany and in the world, the capital of which amounted to 300 million marks in 1914. Year 1852, letters received 6,135, letters dispatched 6,292. Year 1870, letters received 85,800, letters dispatched 87,513. Year 1900, letters received 533,102, letters dispatched 626,043. In 1875, the big Paris bank, the Crédit Lyonnais, had 28,535 accounts. In 1912, it had 633,539. These simple figures show, perhaps better than long explanations, how the concentration of capital and the growth of their turnover is radically changing the significance of the banks. Scattered capitalists are transformed into a single collective capitalist. When carrying the current accounts of a few capitalists, the banks, as it were, transact a purely technical and exclusively auxiliary operation. When, however, these operations grow to enormous dimensions, we find that a handful of monopolists control all the operations, both commercial and industrial, of capitalist society. They can, by means of their banking connections, by running current accounts and transacting other financial operations, first ascertain exactly the position of the various capitalists, then control them, influence them by restricting or enlarging, facilitating or hindering their credits, and finally, they can entirely determine their fate, determine their income, deprive them of capital, or, on the other hand, permit them to increase their capital rapidly and to enormous proportions, etc. We have just mentioned the 300 million marks capital of the Disconto Gesellschaft of Berlin. The increase of the capital of this bank to this high figure was one of the incidents in the struggle for hegemony between two of the biggest Berlin banks, the Deutsche Bank and the Disconto. In 1870, the Deutsche Bank, a new enterprise, had a capital of only 15 million marks, while that of the Disconto was as much as 30 million marks. In 1908, the first had a capital of 200 million, while the second only had 170 million. In 1914, the Deutsche Bank increased its capital to 250 million, and the Disconto, by absorbing a very important bank, the Schaffhausen Bankverein, increased its capital to 300 million. And of course, while this struggle for hegemony goes on, the two banks more and more frequently conclude agreements of an increasingly durable character with each other. The development of banking lead specialists in the study of banking questions, who regard economic questions from a standpoint which does not in the least exceed the bounds of the most moderate and cautious bourgeois reformism, to the following conclusions. The German review, Die Bank, commenting on the increase of the capital of the Disconto Gesellschaft to 300 million marks, writes, "Other banks will follow its example, and in time, the 300 men, who today govern German economically, will gradually be reduced to 50, 25, or still fewer. It cannot be expected that this new move towards concentration will be confined to banking. The close relations that exist between certain banks naturally involve the bringing together of the manufacturing combines which they patronize. One fine morning, we shall wake up in surprise to see nothing but trusts before our eyes, and to find ourselves faced with the necessity of substituting state monopolies for private monopolies. However, we have nothing to reproach ourselves with, except with having allowed things to follow their own course, slightly accelerated by the manipulation of stocks. This is a very good example of the importance of bourgeois journalism, which differs from bourgeois science only in that the latter is less sincere and strives to obscure essential things, to conceal the wood by trees. To be surprised at the results of concentration, to reproach the government of a capitalist Germany or capitalist society ourselves, to fear that the introduction of stocks and shares might hasten concentration, as the German cartel specialist Schiersky fears the American trusts and prefers the German cartels on the grounds that they do not, like the trusts, hasten technical economic progress to an excessive degree. Is this not impotence? But facts remain facts. There are no trusts in Germany, there are only cartels. But Germany is governed by not more than 300 magnates, and the number of these is constantly diminishing. At all events, banks in all capitalist countries, no matter what the law in regard to them may be, accelerate the process of concentration of capital and the formation of monopolies. The banking system, Marx wrote half a century ago in Capital, presents indeed the form of universal bookkeeping and of distribution of means of production on a social scale, but only the form. The figures we have quoted on the development of bank capital, on the increase in the number of branches and offices of the biggest banks, the increase in the number of their accounts, etc., presents a concrete picture of this universal bookkeeping of the whole capitalist class, and not only of the capitalists, for the banks collect, even though temporarily, all kinds of financial revenues of small businessmen, office clerks, and of a small upper stratum of the working class. It is universal distribution of means of production that, from the formal point of view, grows out of the development of modern banks, the most important of which, numbering from 3 to 6 in France and from 6 to 8 in Germany, control billions and billions. In point of fact, however, the distribution of means of production is by no means universal but private, i.e., it conforms to the interests of big capital, and primarily of very big monopoly capital, which operates in conditions in which the masses of the population live in want, in which the whole development of agriculture hopelessly lags behind the development of industry, and within industry itself, the heavy industries extract tribute from all other branches of industry. The savings banks and post offices are beginning to compete with banks in the matter of socializing capitalist economy. They are more decentralized, i.e., their influence extends to a greater number of localities, to more remote places, to wider sections of the population. An American commission has collected the following data on the comparative growth of deposits in banks and savings banks. Deposits in billions of marks. Year 1880, England, banks 8.4, savings banks 1.6. France, banks unknown, savings banks 0.9. Germany, banks 0.5, credit societies 0.4, savings banks 2.6. Year 1888, England, banks 12.4, savings banks 2.0. France, banks 1.5, savings banks 2.1. Germany, banks 1.1, credit societies 0.4, savings banks 4.5. Year 1908, England, banks 23.2, savings banks 4.2. France, banks 3.7, savings banks 4.2. Germany, banks 7.1, credit societies 2.2, savings banks 13.9. As they pay interest at the rate of 4% and 4.5% on deposits, the savings banks must seek profitable investments for their capital. They must deal in bills, mortgages, etc. Thus, the boundaries between the banks and the savings banks become more and more obliterated. The chambers of commerce at Bochum and Erfurt, for example, demand that savings banks be prohibited from engaging in purely banking business, such as discounting bills. They also demand the limitation of the banking operations of the post office. The banking magnates seem to be afraid that the state monopoly will steal upon them from an unexpected quarter. It goes without saying, however, that this fear is no more than the expression, as it were, of the rivalry between two department managers in the same office, for on one hand, the billions entrusted to the savings banks are actually controlled by these very same bank magnates, while, on the other hand, state monopoly in capitalist society is nothing more than a means of increasing and guaranteeing the income of millionaires on the verge of bankruptcy in one branch of industry or another. The change from the old type of capitalism, in which free competition predominated, to the new capitalism in which monopoly reigns, is expressed, among other things, by a decrease in the importance of the stock exchange. The German review, Die Bank, wrote, "For a long time now, the stock exchange has ceased to be the indispensable intermediary of circulation that it was formerly when the banks were not yet able to place with their clients the greater part of their issues. Every bank is a stock exchange, and the bigger the bank and the more successful the concentration of banking is, the truer does this modern proverb become. While formerly, in the 70s, the stock exchange, flushed with the exuberance of youth, a delicate allusion to the crash of 1873 and to the stock flotation scandals, opened the era of industrialization of Germany by utilizing the gambling chance that lies in stocks. Nowadays, the bank and industry are able to do it alone. The domination of our big banks over the stock exchange is nothing more than the expression of the completely organized German industrial state. If the domain of the automatically functioning economic laws is thus restricted, and if the domain consciously regulated by the banks is considerably increased, the national economic responsibility of a very small number of guiding heads is infinitely increased," wrote Professor Schulz Gavernitz, an apologist of German imperialism, who is regarded as an authority by the imperialists of all countries, and who tries to gloss over a detail, viz. That the conscious regulation of economic life by the banks is robbery of the public by a handful of completely organized monopolists. For the task of a bourgeois professor is not to lay bare the mechanisms of the financial system, or to divulge all the machinations of the finance monopolists, but rather to present them in a favorable light. In the same way, Reiser, a still more authoritative economist and a banker himself, makes shift with meaningless phrases in order to explain away undeniable facts. He says, "The stock exchange is steadily losing the feature which is absolutely essential for commerce and industry as a whole, and for the circulation of securities in particular, that of being an exact measuring rod and an almost automatic regulator of the economic movements which converge on it." In other words, the old capitalism, the capitalism of free competition and its indispensable regulator, the stock exchange, are passing away. A new capitalism is succeeding it, which bears obvious features of something transitory, which is a mixture of free competition and monopoly. The question naturally arises, to what is this new transitory capitalism leading? But the bourgeois scholars are afraid to raise this question. 30 years ago, employers freely competing against one another performed 9/10 of the economic work which is outside the sphere of manual labor. At the present time, 9/10 of this economic brainwork is performed by officials. Banking is in the forefront of this evolution. This admission by Schulz Gavernitz brings us once again to the question of what this new capitalism, capitalism in its imperialist stage, is leading to. Among the few banks which, as a result of the process of concentration, remain at the head of all capitalist economy, there is naturally to be observed an increasingly marked tendency towards monopolist agreements, towards a bank trust. In America, there are not 9, but 2 big banks. Those of the billionaires Rockefeller and Morgan, which control a capital of 11 billion marks. In Germany, the absorption of the Schaffhausenschen Bankverein by the Diskonto Gesellschaft, to which we referred above, was commented on in the following terms by the Frankfurter Zeitung, one of the organs of the stock exchange interests. "The concentration movement of the banks is narrowing the circle of establishments from which it is possible to obtain large credits and consequently is increasing the dependence of large-scale industry upon a small number of banking groups. In view of internal links between industry and finance, the freedom of movement of manufacturing companies in the need of bank capital is restricted. For this reason,